George Makowski, superintendent of schools in Valdez, and have been given the assignment to moderate this, which is good. It means I don't have to be committal, and we can let the experts on our panel commit themselves and hopefully commit some of you in the audience. I would like to introduce our panelists. On my immediate left is Bruce Bethello, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Alaska. And next we have Peter Partnow from Helen Partnow and Condon, represents various school districts within the State of Alaska. And we have John Patterson, who is General Counsel for the National Education Association for the State of Alaska. And finally we have Gary Thurlow, who's manager of the Mat-Su Borough and also an attorney in Alaska and California. I'd like to welcome you to this session. The way we want to organize this discussion is I have raised three separate questions and I have some comments on it. I will go through those three questions and comments, and then we will have the panelists discuss and make statements, raise some issues on the first question, then we'll go to the second question, then we'll go to the third question, and then we'll open it up for audience participation. If that's okay with you, fine. If it's not, too bad. I would like to point out an error in the program. That error was due to me in the printing. The second question should be, does the state system of funding for education depict an equitable formula? And then what's stated as the question should be the comment. I'll go ahead now and go through my set of questions for those that might not have it. The first question deals in the area of school administration, school boards, and the local community. Are school administrators being required to hold Juris Doctoral degrees or hire as a part of the full-time staff attorneys specially trained in school-related matters in order to maintain a trouble-free district? The comment is that it seems that we in education are always faced with the problem of litigation, whether it be in the classroom or with our employees. And we rely heavily upon the courts and the attorneys to make decisions that affect us in education. The comment speaks to possibly having legal schools, universities, crank out administrators, teachers that have legal backgrounds to help preclude us from getting involved in those areas. But then also the comment says that maybe we're just creating mountains out of molehills. Maybe we're getting too involved in those areas and we're too afraid of dealing in an educationally manner and being legitimate rather than worrying about all the problems within the law and the court system. I feel very strongly that if we were totally legitimate and acted with reasonableness and common sense, we wouldn't have problems with attorneys and courts. It's a nice statement, but it's hard to follow, I guess. I guess we can go ahead and start with Bruce and work our way down, and then we'll reverse that procedure the next time.
George, I didn't realize you had problems with attorneys. I like to think that they're one of your best friends, at least from the litigation we get out of some of our districts, you'd think so. The questions, in case you're not aware of it, if you have the brochure, you'll find that there is a section in the back which has verbatim the question that George has posed to us as well as his commentary. I'm not going to tackle it at all, but I'll give a couple reactions that occur to me in some of the text. First of all, there are some assumptions in there in the question itself, and I won't deal with the first portion, which talks about school administrators being required to have Juris Doctoral degrees. there are a couple other assumptions there, and that is, first of all, there are attorneys who are especially trained in school law. I think you'll find that if you were to look around and you're trying to find somebody straight out of law school who has trained in education law to hire as your full-time staff person for legal matters, you won't find that person, because by and large, from a education, law, legal education standpoint, there's very little in the legal curriculum of most any law school that deals with education law. So there's an assumption we have to just bring up briefly. And presuming that you do have that legal scholar, again, I think it probably is too presumptuous to assume that that scholar is going to do anything to help the district maintain a trouble-free atmosphere, because the litigation obviously comes from decisions that are made either at the school board level, sometimes at the administrative level, and most frequently what happens in the classroom. You have myriad numbers of individuals who are making decisions daily that could end up in litigation. And of course, the filing of a suit doesn't intimate any view on the merits of it. So whether or not you have an attorney on board really, I think, is an illusion if you think it's somehow or another going to slow down the kinds of legal problems that you will experience in the district. Reacting to the comment which George has there, I'm going to focus on only one part, and that is a comment halfway through, which talks about if the regulations were clear and legitimate, we wouldn't have to determine their intent in a courtroom. And I think that's a very, very important and I think rather accurate statement. And this is an area that I can fault, I think, having worked with the Department of Education over the last several years, as well as other departments, a problem that we have in perhaps in two sides. First of all, the Department of Education, which comes up with the idea of a regulation, goes ahead, tries to get it introduced, and we determine that there's fuzzy language. And we should catch it, but we don't always. In fact, judging from a lot of the litigation we have, we seldom seem to catch a lot of the fuzzy language. But there are two things that any school district or any citizen can do to try and perhaps preempt some of that fuzzy language in regulations, or for that matter in statutes, but especially in regulations. Every regulation which is promulgated in this state as a permanent regulation must provide for public input. And with respect to regulations done by the Department of Education, every school district in this state receives a copy of the intent or the decision by the Board of Education to promulgate regulations, and it specifically invites public comment. And frankly, very few school districts take the time in the state to comment on any of those regulations except as they specifically affect money. And those tend to be the foundation questions, pupil transportation, and sometimes certification for school administrators, since it's the school administrator who usually attends Board of Education meetings. The point to be made is that if you're really concerned at a local level about the quality of regulations, then it behooves you to make sure that you review regulations being promulgated by the department. That may be regarded as a somewhat passive role, that is, simply to review something initiated by the Department of Education. One of the most seldom recognized and even less utilized provisions of the Administrative Procedure Act, which provides for public participation in the adoption of regulations by government agencies, is language which specifically allows any member of the public to initiate a regulation. And that is to say, either to initiate a new one, or to amend an old one, or to repeal an old regulation. And all that it really requires is you to request the agency to deal with a specific area. They have 30 days by law to act on your recommendation by either telling you that they're not going to go ahead and do it, or to actually schedule public notice and hearings on those matters. And I can tell you that in my experience in 7 years with the Attorney General's office, I've only seen two of those, and I work with several state agencies. So again, particularly if you're concerned about, do we have quality regulations? Do they make sense? If they don't, you have a particular mechanism to bring that to the attention of the public. And if you're really truly committed to avoiding litigation and cleaning up the mess, that's the way to do it. That's maybe my initial reaction.
Good afternoon. I believe my comments on this are going to approach it somewhat differently, maybe pick up on a couple of the things that Bruce had said. What I did, well, typically for me, I was late in getting my written comments such as they were down, but having looked at what George did and what the others did, I sort of approached it in light of what this conference was going to be about, and the bottom line being what suggestions, if any, might there be for changes in legislation. And from my point of view, I think one thing that Bruce said is very true, that if you look through the bills that get all the action in the legislature every year, and the area where the most bills are introduced, in fact, you look at the material which is submitted for this conference, and the vast majority of things deal with funding issues. And that's, in some ways, that's understandable. If there's a high enough level of funding, almost all the other problems will ultimately disappear. Assuming, as many of our public officials are now saying, that that is not going to continue to be the case, that there's going to be, we're getting at some point to the bottom of the barrel, at some point, the way that people are going to continue to operate efficiently or effectively is going to have to be cutting costs somewhere else rather than adding it to the bottom line. And again, to say that things are only spoken to that affect money, ultimately, I think in the area that most of you are dealing with, almost everything ultimately costs money. If you are suspending a student or having a protest over your fish stick bids or non-retaining a teacher or anything, when you get sued, you have to pay your lawyer. Even if you don't get sued, you have to devote administrative time, perhaps expert time, consultant time to deal with the particular problem you're dealing with. And the more open to challenge you are, the more you may end up having to spend in dealing with these things. And the more confusion that exists in terms of your knowing how to address the problems, the more likely it's going to be that these problems are going to consume time and consume money. So the approach that I took to this, and just to, I suppose, throw out some ideas, particularly with John Patterson coming up behind me, I'll throw him a few hanging curveballs, are various things that might possibly deal with some of these issues, not just give us more money or give us more money according to a different formula. And what I'll do is just speak very quickly to some ideas that I had dealing with this area, and then there's when George comes back to the second and third items, I have a couple of other things that had occurred to me. I also would note that whatever ideas I'm throwing out are just my own opinions and not necessarily the positions or opinions of any clients that I represent. I've cited a number of items initially in the labor area, which I think are deal that all school districts, be they large or small, have problems with. I suppose one area that is, I think, of concern to me, and particularly with the larger districts, has to do with non-certificated employees. If you'll note, looking through the Alaska statutes, it's a group of employees that whose existence doesn't exist according to Alaska statutes. They're not mentioned anywhere. Particularly looking at the area of collective bargaining, the area of retention and non-retention of such individuals. As somebody who represents school boards, I, of course, would like to see statutes enacted that preserved as much discretion as possible for the management side in terms of dealing with those issues. But I think that both sides are probably well served in having the issue at least addressed in the first instance, whether people have the right to collective bargain, if there is an unfair labor practice, who deals with it, if one union tries to take over from another union, who referees the dispute, who counts the ballots, who determines what unit of employees is most associated with what other unit of employees in order to form the bargaining units. The state, for its employees, has a multi-section labor relations act that deals in some detail with all these issues. For school districts, and particularly the larger districts, you're out there on your own, and every time you deal with the unions and every time the unions or the employees deal with you, you're both in an area where the guidelines or the ground rules are basically what you agree them to be, and there's nothing that directs you any further than that as far as I can see. In the area of certificated staff, relative to the question of collective bargaining, I know, obviously, that there's a lot of concern going on in the legislature every year relative to the issue, the right to strike, binding interest arbitration. I have some strong opinions on that issue, but without reaching that particular issue, just a minor change in the statute, which might possibly be of some assistance to districts, is the way our statute is set up. When there is an impasse between a school district and the certificated staff, the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service is supposed to be called in to mediate the dispute and to issue a mediation report if the dispute isn't mediated. Well, basically, the FMCS is an agency of the federal government, and the state law cannot compel that organization to undertake that role. As a practical matter, in most cases that I'm aware of, that role has been assumed, and the individuals have done a very professional and helpful job. But given the size of the staff available here, just the number of school districts, if they were the only people who these people had to deal with, there are just not the time or the willingness to draft a detailed report saying, well, the teachers wanted this and that's stupid, and the school board wants that and that's stupid. What happens is, if the parties aren't brought together, and they proceed on to the next step of negotiations without the public certainly having anybody who is in a position of being neutral defining what the issues appear to be on the bargaining table. My understanding from a number of other states is when you have a neutral fact finder who serves in this position to say that these are the issues, that in some but in not all cases enough public opinion can be marshaled on specific issues in order to have the public pressure lead the parties to an agreement. And I think that one of the reasons why there might be some problem with the statute the way it's drafted is because the statute is not interpreted or implemented as it's drafted, and as a result we've never had any sort of real fact-finding for school district labor disputes in this state. Another area that I think is worthy of some concern has to do with the whole area of termination of employees. As I'm sure all of you are aware, certificated staff have substantial rights established by the statutes, and I have no qualms with those rights having been established and certain job protection and job security being there. However, a number of these statutes were adopted and have been in effect since long before such things as mandatory annual professional evaluations occurred, before the vast majority of the certificated staff in all of the school districts became unionized, before mandatory interest arbitration was mandated in all collective bargaining agreements between school districts and their certificated staff. And as a result of all these things, in my opinion, a lot of the ground rules have changed. I don't believe that a school board or a school district can, in most cases, be as unilateral or high-handed in dealing with people. They may still be in some occasions, but I think there are a lot of safeguards that are built in that didn't exist 10 years ago, yet there's no recognition of that in the statutes the other way. The teacher can still acquire tenure within 2 years, for instance. The causes for which a tenure teacher can be terminated are extremely limited, and as I can note from personal experience, very difficult to prove. And the question is whether the school district should be put in a position where it takes countless man hours of their staff, countless dollars of their limited resources to deal with these issues, to the point where I think almost anybody who deals in the area would concede that it's only in the most extreme cases where anybody resorts to this procedure in the first place. And even when they ultimately do resort to the process, it's extremely expensive, time-consuming, and unpleasant for everybody involved, no matter who wins. Added on top of that, you have the situation that our state law and our state judicial decision interpreting that law indicate that in most cases where a teacher has lost their job, they have a right to a de novo hearing in the Superior Court, and basically that whatever decision that the school board made is not entitled to any weight, or not even looked at, essentially, by the Superior Court. And one would question why or if it is worth spending tens of thousands of dollars and countless man hours in order to go through a protracted proceeding which basically you have the possibility of throwing it out and doing it all over again when you get to court. And to me, it seems that this is a disservice to both the employee and the employer in terms of the number of times that this particular fire drill has to be gone through and the amount of time and money involved. It seems to me that there are some fairly simple things that could at least be considered that might improve situations regarding this this area. And again, some of the things that I might throw out would be a legislative change indicating that when termination cases are appealed to courts from school boards, that the court give some deference to the school board opinion, the school board being the publicly elected representatives of the people in that area for that purpose, and presumably, although not always, representing the values of the people in the community that they serve. Secondly, that in terms of the tenure laws, that either the time that be required to obtain tenure be increased to 3 or 4 years, or alternatively, in the case of individual employees whose performance is marginal but not necessarily terrible, that some sort of a probationary period be established so that the school district is not faced with a decision of either having to fire or give tenure to an employee who they're not really sure of. It seems to me that that second alternative might be in the employee's interest as well, and give the employee the additional amount of time that might be necessary to prove that they would be a good employee. Thirdly, it seems to me that some efforts should be taken to more clearly spell out the types of procedures that are legally permissible when a hearing occurs before the school board in this situation. Again, I think most school boards, either by their own policy or by ad hoc procedures, adopt the way that they're going to proceed in individual cases. And as a result, there are many areas where so-called procedural objections or potential objections are built into the proceeding, and one is not sure how those things are going to be dealt with when one ultimately gets to court. Again, it seems to me that both the teacher and the employer are well served by knowing exactly what the ground rules are at all stages of the proceeding, so that these types of potential glitches and the expense involved in that could be avoided. A final point that may or may not be worthy of some consideration has to do with perhaps either broadening or at least redefining the basis for which the grounds, if you will, for termination of a tenured teacher. The example I would look now is we have one of the grounds for terminating a teacher is immorality, which is defined as commission of a crime involving moral turpitude. I would submit that that, for all intents and purposes, particularly in light of at least one judicial decision I'm aware of, that cause is essentially non-existent in existing statutes, that if somebody commits a crime of moral turpitude in terms of what most people here, I think at least, believe to be a crime involving moral turpitude, you're probably not faced with a non-retention situation, but rather determining the address to send the card to the person who's in jail. We are aware of a case now where an individual who is a civics teacher in a school district and essentially somehow hot-wired their electrical box to avoid the meter and thereby got thousands of dollars worth of electrical services without paying for it, was able to convince at least one Superior Court judge that that did not involve moral turpitude. That may or may not be the case, but I would leave you with a question as to whether your child or your friend's child or any student in your system should be taught civics and how to be a good citizen by somebody who is going to court that afternoon to accept his sentencing for having indulged in this type of activity. And in that case, John, it's all yours.
Hi, Peter. Peter, I represented a guy who was accused of that, and I know he was innocent. So. How do we know? Peter's up here telling us he was guilty. Mr. Partnow has gone into sort of a lobbying effort here. I'm going to try to get back to the original question. I certainly would like to get into some of the questions that Mr. Partnow raised, though. First of all, I would like to agree with Mr. Makowski here that that from what I've observed, the administrators who in good faith attempt to look at the regulations, look at the laws, and make a fair, good faith attempt to abide by them, generally don't have a great deal of trouble. The trouble results from administrators who attempt to stretch those regulations or just to see if they can get away with them. Just this week, a superintendent told John Strawn that he would try to do just about anything until he was told not to. And in this case, he had done something that I think had been pretty well precluded to him by a case that came down from the Supreme Court in 1972. And everyone knows about this case, and he knows about it, and I know his attorney knows about it, because we've run it across his desk about 25 times. These regulations and laws, from what I've observed, the ones that Mr. Partnow has been interested in and Mr. Botello are laws that generally just, it's not a matter of lack of clarity, it's a matter of a state that simply does not have enough time to build up a body of laws, statutory law, to fill in all the voids. If you could compare Alaska's education code and laws with California's, you'd see that California has a quite different approach. You could find an answer to just about everything down there. I will admit that there are plenty of cases out of California which suggest that maybe that isn't the entire answer, but in this case, it would help. And certainly Mr. Partnow's suggestion that the procedural approach to non-retention hearings might well be better addressed in the statutes is well taken. There are there's very little guidance there, and Mr. Partnow and I participated in one this year where we had kind of an ad hoc procedure, and he's right. If we had gone to court with that thing, I would have attacked it, even though I willingly participated in it. And perhaps that isn't appropriate. Perhaps we should have a better procedure, a way for school boards to conduct four-week non-retention hearings under some sort of a reasonable procedure. Right now, we don't have it. On the question of clarity of regulations, I would suggest that unless we're talking about some particular regulation, that this discussion really isn't all that meaningful. You can look at an example would be the materialman's lien laws in a state. The contractors, the carpenters, the laborers are expected to read that statute, which some people who work on it for years never understand, and understand it. It's just something that occurs when you have a closely regulated area. That doesn't mean that the carpenters and the mechanics are going to have specially trained people to interpret the mechanics lien statute. It's just going to happen. When you have a statute and you're attempting precision, you're going to almost necessarily have a certain degree of wordiness, where you are trying to cover all sorts of contingencies. And sometimes the confusion is more apparent than it is real. But I think that school administrators are the least put upon, because as I understand it, most of them take some sort of a school law course and probably have more input into these things than certainly than the carpenter does. I'm just not real upset about the administrators having to read the statutes. Sorry, Mr. Pekowski. I wish I could get into it. Has anybody looked at the hunting regulations? I was out hunting a couple years ago. I saw a caribou run across the road, and it took me 30 minutes to find out whether I could shoot that caribou or not. Well, it was gone. I maybe should have had a hunting expert there with me. But it's life in the fast lane, I think. Now, Mr. Partnow's, I don't know if we're ever going to get back to tenure or not, and whether teachers should be terminated on broader grounds, but just in case we don't, I'd like to make sure that I cover this and not leave Mr. Partnow's remarks uncovered. I have observed that administrators are not always interested just in terminating bad teachers. That oftentimes that their interest is in terminating teachers that they simply decide they want to terminate. Now, we should have a system. Surely any group of fair-minded people will understand that we should have a system that allows people who are competent to come in and contest it, even in the face of somebody who has his administrative certificate saying that a teacher is incompetent. That's what the system is designed to do, and that's all it does. I really don't know just where Mr. Partnow wants to expand the reasons for non-retention. We've got incompetence, and the definition in the statutes and in the cases for incompetence is not that narrow. We've got substantial noncompliance. Well, if a teacher tells you to whatever with your regulation, if it's a major import, it's a substantial noncompliance, and he can go. If he tells you whatever about some regulation and it's not of import, if he does it again, then perhaps that's substantial noncompliance. But there's nothing wrong with that. There isn't anybody in this room who has obeyed every regulation, every order from a superior his whole life, and I doubt if you've been fired about it. The standards aren't that vague. The reasons are substantial enough. And in the immorality area, I don't know what Mr. Partnow wants, but if we, I'd like to take a vote here. How many people here would like to see teachers non-retained for cohabitation? Oh, yeah? Thank you.
I'm Gary Thurlow, Mat-Su Borough. I see Pete tried to pick a fight with John and vice versa, so to keep you guys awake, I got to find someone to fight with. I picked Bruce here, who's with the Attorney General's office. And my enemy is pork, but you see a lot of pork here in the state in the last several days, last several years. But let me tell you where the pork is. I think Governor Sheffield talked to you or some of you this morning. He said 45% of the state budget goes to education. That's true, I'm sure. It's true in most states. And I think the important thing is that 45% be spent wisely. Maybe it should be more than 45%. I don't like the way 75% of it going to operations is spent, because I don't think the school foundation program is as good as it could be. We had a good system in 1962. It was a model system developed with the help of experts in education finance. The Ford Foundation paid their way here. They worked for a year. What it called for was that a minimum level of educational opportunity for every Alaska school child, and then the taxpayers of the state were supposed to each make an equal effort towards supporting education in their district. In those days, the required expected effort was 3.5 mils, and then that money would go into the requirement for providing a minimum level of education, and then what was left over, the difference, would be made up by the state, and that would bring you up to a minimum level. That meant wherever you went in the state of Alaska, every taxpayer is making equal effort to support education, and the opportunity for education was not a function of the wealth of the school district. We've gotten away from that system over the years. The requirement for any particular local effort has been repealed, and there's a lot of disparities between how much one school district gets versus another. In Mat-Su Borough, because of a very rapid growth, I expect that the local share will go up from about $9 million this year to about $15, $16 million next year. That's because all those people moving into the borough don't pay their way. The houses they build, and in a valley, the assessed value of those houses isn't enough to pay for the cost of educating the children that come in those houses. So we fall behind when you don't have a tax equalization measure. Now, when I talk about pork, I'm talking about 25% of the state's education budget. Of that 25%, about half of the money goes out to municipalities as 100% grants. And there's really no rhyme or reason how that money gets out. But I can tell you part of the mechanism, and see what you think of it. Imagine a great big pie. Now, Governor Sheffield has a third, the Senate has a third, and the House has a third. Now, I assume that Governor Sheffield will try to put some school projects in his third, probably the REAAs, the Regional Education Attendance Area schools. He'll probably try to stick some of those in his third, probably get some money for those schools. And then what about House's third? We got two representatives and a senator in a Mat-Su Borough. How would our requirements be met? We're getting about as many new kids up there each year as you're getting here in Anchorage. I assume a lot of you are from Anchorage. Okay, how do you house those kids? How do you make those decisions? How much money should be built to put roofs over these kids' heads. Well, first you get a computer. First you decide who's the majority and who's the minority. Okay, after you do that, then you figure out how much the majority get and how much does the minority get. Well, Joe Hayes, I got part of his deposition here, he says for every dollar the minority gets, the majority's going to get $9. I think that might not be that bad, but that's what the deposition says. Okay, for that $9, how do you divide that up? Well, you get this computer and you give everybody a number, each member of the majority coalition, and you tell that guy or woman to plug in their secret wish into that computer, and that computer will record it. There won't be a record of who put that wish in the list, but that will finally come out as a proposed into a proposed budget. And all kinds of marvelous things will happen when you use that system. You'll get $2,000 appropriated to replace carpet in assembly area of the Tudor Elementary School. Now, I just wonder what John Lisko is doing at that time. My wife teaches at Homestead Elementary School. They have a frayed carpet. Why wasn't any attention given to that carpet? $7,300 appropriated to high-speed copier. $153,000 appropriated to Election District 11 for microcomputers. That's downtown Anchorage. Election District 15. What's wrong with Election District 14 kids? Are they just too slow mentally to handle microcomputers? And then a microcomputer for Roger Park Elementary School and so forth. And so you get a budget for school buildings. What I would hope is that school buildings could be handled the same way that school operation cost should be handled, and that's based upon need. There's plenty of cases in other parts of the United States where things have gone way off the track, and they're usually based upon some wealthy school districts getting a disproportionate amount of the pie and poor school district getting too little. And the cases come out on the basis that to have a system of education, you're going to have to find a way of equalizing educational opportunity. You base those cases upon provisions of state constitutions providing for a system of public education. You don't have a public system of education where it's pork. And you base those cases on the equal protection of laws provisions of those state constitutions. And you don't have equal educational opportunities unless you look at the ability to pay in these individual school districts. And you look at the educational needs in these individual school districts. We filed a court, Van Duskus, who sit in the boroughs, filed a court challenging the way the state of Alaska allocates money for capital improvements. And we're relying on cases primarily from the state of California, from New Jersey, and West Virginia. So we have high hopes that the system will be straightened out. We have a tremendous amount at stake because we're double shifting Iditarod Elementary School in Wasilla next year. We're double shifting Wasilla Junior High School next year. We're expecting probably another 20% increase next year. We had 20% increase this year. And we have to find a way of housing those children, and the money isn't there under the present system to do it.
Well, that led us right into our next question, which is a nice cue. On that first question, maybe one thing that we could keep in mind for the third one, I tried to keep the first question to the local level away from the state level, to help school administrators become more competent, whether the attorney should write the policies, et cetera, et cetera. But maybe we could address some of those issues in the third question, which deals with the state level regulations. All right, second question is, does the state system of funding for education depict an equitable formula? Common is that I think it could provide a system of area equalized funding for education, which would include a cost for capital improvements for each local education agency and REAA. I think that funding should be set in some kind of a restricted account within the state and be made available for communities upon application based upon need. Definitely, local districts should be able to add to this system of funding if they wanted to and had the resources. There also would have to be possibly some type of an emergency funding set for areas that were not planned for in advance for a rapid growth, which I still think also we should be able to take a look at 2, 3, 4 years down the future and be able to know where the high increase in population centers are and what that projected growth is to some degree. However, an emergency fund would be available for that. One of the things that I feel an account, whether it be an endowment fund, restricted account, whatever the experts in the finances determine it should be, would lessen the amount of dollars that the state of Alaska would spend for school construction. When you work a debt retirement program, you have to pay it back with interest, and you pay back considerably more dollars for a relatively small project. If you had this in a fund, the fund would generate interest, it would grow, you would be planning ahead, and at the same time costing the state of Alaska less money to provide for school construction. How that would affect my district, I could go to our community and our school board and say, well, yeah, we want that really nice technical center for our vocational students. However, we won't be able to get that for another 6 years, but that's okay. We can plan real well for 6 years and then have it. Why don't we, Gary, you went ahead and introduced that one, so why don't we go with John and work this way back.
I'm sure that Mr. Thurlow is going to have an awful lot more to say about this than anybody. He's got himself about a 400-page brief down there on it. He's working on this. I just don't know enough about the process for funding these schools. I know that my client has given me very little guidance here and is interested in the education of all the students in Alaska. I can't tell from Mr. Thurlow's comments or what his case is trying to accomplish, whether the result is going to be taking the money from the big schools or from the little schools. It seems to me that the REAAs probably get 100% financing, and that in that regard there would be some taken from them. I have observed, this is strictly my observation, that there is quite a bit of waste in operating some of these school districts. I think that probably that's an area that should be looked at more closely. That still doesn't answer the question that's been asked here, which is how the money should get out there initially. To answer the question directly and explicitly, I personally find a good bit of good in Mr. Makowski's suggestion. I would like to see more local control, more local responsibility. That it would be very helpful if the districts who happen to have some political clout, because they have the guy in the legislature who's been there since 1900, possibly wouldn't think, because they can get their technical center this year, they can get a new swimming pool next year. I think it's fair. I would guess that Mr. Makowski is having trouble getting funds and is not in one of the situations where he's got the real heavy-duty legislator, but as a result of that, I think he's made a reasonable suggestion, and as far as I personally am concerned, I would, if given an opportunity to vote on something like this, I would probably vote for it. That doesn't mean NEA is going to do it. Okay? Thank you.
Like John, I think that in this one we're sandwiched between the two litigants in that case, so I think it makes the most sense to let them fight about the existing thing particularly in terms of the construction funding. It does seem to me generally, however, that the districts in the state are best served by way of general principle by a funding system that has two features to it. One is equity in terms of the way the money is distributed, and the other is some degree of certainty. And I think that George's suggestion is, while I'm not sure that specifically as he stated, is something that I would personally favor or not favor it. I think there's an attempt there to have at least those two elements contained. And from my experience practicing law in the education area in this state since 1971, where the first major piece of litigation that I came in contact with was the Molly Hooch litigation, I think that from that time forward it can be said that there has not been, when you weigh rural against urban, organized districts against unorganized districts, and look at both the operational funding and construction funding, that there has not been on a continued basis a system which has the equity and certainty which, regardless of what the legal requirements might be, just from a practical operational point of view, makes sense and is fair. I think the state foundation formula has changed almost annually for the last 3 or 4 years, and it strikes me it would be very difficult for a district to plan their budget from 1 year to the next without, particularly when the statute requires that when you're in an organized district, that you have your budget approved by the municipal assembly or borough assembly and by May 1st, and the legislature is popping along in June and July, and they still haven't decided what formula they're going to adopt or to what level they're going to fund that formula, so that you people know how much money you're going to end up having or out of whose pockets it's going to be coming. One other area that, since people are talking about legal controversies that they're involved in from time to time, one area that relates to the whole funding area, and it's in terms of the total operational costs and the total construction costs, it's not as significant, but there are huge amounts of money involved, and it is a funding issue, and it does relate between the bifurcation of responsibilities between the local level and the state level, has to do with the entire level of student transportation. In my belief, we have a system now that basically places the operational responsibility with the local school district, but places the ultimate financial responsibility and attached uncertainty at the state level. And I believe, from my experience with various districts, it creates a great deal of uncertainty. The system tends to, because the funding that is provided differs for different types of students, it puts a certain incentive on you to try to beef up in some areas and try to skimp in other areas. It puts a great deal of pressure, it seems to me, on the businessmen who are trying to provide the service. They're trying to make money, which is nothing wrong with that, but they're also providing the services. And this is an area where there's a huge capital outlay required in order to get into the area in the first instance. And the again, the uncertainty that's involved from year to year, or as certain contracts expire and new contracts come up, is such that I believe creates a lot of problems there. I'm not sure what the answer is, except that it seems to me there should be a system whereby both the financial responsibility and the operational responsibility are tied together in a system which allows a reasonable and prudent businessman the opportunity to provide a good service and make a reasonable rate of profit, not at the expense of the safety and welfare of the students who are being transported, and to the detriment of the districts whose educational program, the transportation services should meet the needs of the educational program rather than vice versa. It seems to me that, to my recollection, almost every major busing contract in the state, in almost every district that's been awarded for the past several years, has been involved in controversy, and I think that the existing system is part of the cause of that problem, and think that it is an area that could be looked into and hopefully a more sensible system adopted.
The oral argument on the Matsu case wasn't going to take place till January, but I guess it started today. But first, to echo Peter's concern about pupil transportation, I can't help but agree with him, in part because it seems to me most of my legal career has been spent in pupil transportation litigation. There is definitely a problem. I think he's identified one of the real sources, and that is this bifurcated system where the Department of Education is saying to the districts, it's your job to go out and find that person, but remember who's got the purse strings and who's got the final say. There isn't a single contract that does end up in a dispute, even between a contractor and the district, that somehow or another the state doesn't get sucked into. And again, I think it's an area that does need a great deal of work, and perhaps one of the approaches is simply, I hesitate to use the word foundation, but I guess my own suggestion from a state level would be throw the money at the districts without any strings, except making sure that transportation is provided and that it be done in a safe way, and allow the districts to figure out what the most economical and safe way of providing that service is. On to Matsu. I have to say that in part Gary's comments reminds me of the person who has put away his pork and stored it for 5 years and now is complaining about everybody else that's trying to get it. In a couple of respects, we've spent a little time ourselves putting together our brief. I have some statistics here. And it's amazing to me that when you look at state funding for school construction between fiscal years 1978 and 1983, I take the five largest school districts and I'll just run through here very quickly. Anchorage had a per pupil funding of $3,731. Fairbanks North Star Borough, $3,849. Kenai, $4,194. Matsu, $6,812. And Juneau, for the low of $1,990. I'm really not sure what my district's been doing. They're certainly down at the bottom. But there have been some comments made about the legislative process, and I think friends would know that I'm not exactly the strongest and most ardent supporter of the legislature, but on the other hand, the system is not quite as arbitrary as it appears. I think one would find, looking at either the depositions or the actual practice of the legislative process, would show that there is a lot more equity in the system than may first appear, basically based on the horror stories that we read each year. And again, I think Peter's comments about equity and certainty are certainly common issues and certainly the foundation that we'd like to look for. And I think we do have, by and large, an equitable system. We don't have a certain system, but it's one that I don't see any real certainty coming, because that certainty is tied specifically to the money available. And that, as we all know, varies from year to year. We have been in a very fortunate situation, unlike any other state, that we can complain about the amount of money we've got available. I mean, it's incredible to see that the state has put in more than $500 million into education construction since 1977. And it's a phenomenal investment. I think it's also significant to note that despite all the litigation nationwide dealing with public school foundation, and we're told that something in the neighborhood of 38 states have been involved in litigation over their foundation programs, as an example, there is not a single case in the United States that deals with construction monies for school construction. And I can tell you, because I've already seen Gary's brief, they don't have any. And we've spent our time trying to run that down as well. And I think it also says something about the uniqueness of Alaska. The state really has gone out of its way to fund. Has it been equitable? Well, again, if you look at the record generally, you'll find, number one, we've recognized that the REAAs, because they have no tax base, receive essentially 100% funding for all school construction. Taking a look, on the other hand, at the large, or we'll simply call them the municipal school districts, that is city and boroughs. And again, if we look at the legislative process, I think you would find that there has been an incredible sensitivity to funding of school construction around the state, not based on political clout. I think, generally speaking, Gary's depiction of the pie is an accurate one, in the sense that you have a governor who insists that he have his one-third. Actually, I think he asked to have, I was telling this to Gary, it's not that that the governor really is trying to depoliticize the port, simply that he wants it all himself to pass out. Of course, I didn't say that, I'm a state employee, but in any case, what you do have is this general division. But if you look through the process, particularly in the area of education construction, there's a great deal of unanimity in terms of identifying those projects that are most important, and that if you look at where the contributions have come for education construction around the state, you will find not that the governor took care of the one-third that dealt with the REAAs. Instead, what you will find is that the leadership of the House, the leadership of the Senate, and the governor have all agreed on statewide priorities, and they have all contributed to that process. Similarly, you'll find that on area-wide basis, that there has been unanimity in the large part between the House and Senate in deciding, as an example, what are the priorities in Anchorage for funding. You'll also find that there's a great deal of sensitivity about those areas where there really isn't the legislative pull. I think the Mat-Su Borough is a good example of that. And for that matter, Kenai as well, which is involved in litigation over the same issue. As I think most of you are aware, both districts came and they indicated we are the fastest growing districts in the state, which is true, that is in terms of their percentage increase, although Anchorage actually in absolute numbers is by far ahead of even Mat-Su. And they said, we're going to have to build new buildings, and we've got to do it quickly. And the legislature, in reducing the amount of state reimbursement for bonded indebtedness, made an exception this year. Said, we're limited in funds. We see that. That's the prognosis. That's what we're being told. We're going to reduce what we had done the previous year, that is, increased it to 90% reimbursement same year. Because of our projected revenue, we're going to reduce it to 50%. But we recognize that there are two districts in the state who can't make it. They didn't identify it in the bill, but the legislative history is entirely clear. And they basically said, for those two districts, we're going to allow them to continue at 90% for this year, giving them an opportunity to put a measure or measures in front of their respective electorates on or before October 15th to go ahead and fund those projects. That's the kind of accommodation the legislature has shown. And I think sensitivity towards the need for equity and to accommodate the varied needs in this state. Obviously, there may be ways of improving the system, but I think one has to look at also at the, to the extent that one argues from a municipal school district which has taxing power, that let's see if we can't get the legislature to foot the whole bill. Invariably, and I can't see any way out of it, you have to realize that if you make that legislative choice, you are also going to have to give up some measure of local control. And frankly, that's been the real tension in the state, the battle between local control and state regulation. And at the bottom line of it all is the question of money. The state's going to pay for it. The state is going to regulate it. It's going to have to decide. I think George made reference to his vocational technical center. That may very well be a high priority for a particular school district. I'll pick on Valdez for a moment here. But if you're going to decide, you're going to let the state say it's going to fund 100% of the projects, it means the pie is smaller. That is, the state's pie is smaller. And the state's going to have to be finally making the decision whether that particular vocational technical center really is justified. My suggestion to you is, and I think despite the fact that there are a few cases, courts in this country, which have gone along with California in striking down their foundation programs, that by and large, what you're going to find is an oft-repeated language to the effect that local taxation is the ultimate measure of local control, and that that is really where you have your stake in what's going to happen. And if you give that up, you can expect, and you're going to expect government regulation from the state level. That's the risk. Again, I don't stand here to defend the legislative process. Well, I will defend the legislative process, not any given legislature, but I think by and large you're going to find that it does operate rather equitably, that compared with any other state, both the foundation program and the capital projects are one of the soundest in the country. And the kind of disparity that California had doesn't exist in Alaska. And the kind of disparity that took place in New Jersey, which struck down its foundation program, does not exist in Alaska. And the third case actually is out of Connecticut, as I recall, Gary. Again, we don't have the same types of problems where you have 70% of school funding being taken place at the local government level, which was the real problem in most of those areas. We have exactly the opposite picture in Alaska, and there are only a few states that can claim that kind of credit. So that's my pitch for you folks.
just to comment on the intent for equity, I do believe that there is all the intents in the world for equity in our system, and I think the state of Alaska has done a tremendous lot of goodwill and in good faith for the people of Alaska. However, when you have a system where you have a priority list and you rank that priority 1 year and then change that priority the next year, it seems to me we've lost a little bit of equity there, where 1 year it was important and the next year somebody else is important, is more important than your year the year before. And that's the intent of looking down the road, that yes, I can realize that people don't think my vocational center is very important. However, maybe 6 years down the road it can be a reality and I can accept that. And hopefully we'll get more time and come back to this. The next question was picked up by somebody. It's papered. The next question deals with rules and regulations at the local level, or not local level, but at the state level. And who makes the laws and regulations that affect education in the local communities? In other words, we have a state school board that makes regulations. We have the legislative process that makes legislation. And it would seem to me that we have organizations within the state of Alaska that are very knowledgeable in education, the state school board, the administrators association, principals, teachers associations. And it would seem to me that, yes, we all do have the ability to comment publicly, but we're all human and we don't do it, that maybe a system would be provided that would force us to comment through the use of task force approach or something like that in order to review those regulations. So we'll go back down the row.
Well, this will be the Jekyll and Hyde. As much as I can comment on the one hand about fairness perhaps in funding, I can make some other comments that indicate the other side. In terms of other education-related issues, obviously the pressure points are twofold. One is the State Board of Education. The other, I think probably more critically in the long run, is the legislature itself, because it sets the overall policy, leaving to the Board of Education and to the Department of Education staff the responsibility of carrying out those decisions. And in that respect, I think, George, your suggestion of task forces particularly lends itself to the Board of Education, where there's perhaps not the pressure to make decisions quickly. Well, there's always that pressure, but it's not the same as the legislative process, where you've got 60 people who can't stand Juneau and want to get out as quickly as possible. At least that's what they tell us. They want to get out. And education is only a small part of the big picture. And for some of them, it's the last part of the big picture. And fortunately, we have others who consider education to be really important. And this seems to be a critical area from a couple standpoints, because clout then seems to play a critical role, and that is certain school boards or school districts which have hired lobbyists, essentially, are able to exercise their influence in ways which none of us entirely understand. I remember one example, which I have to relate because it's the classic as far as I'm concerned. I was involved in writing an opinion about a school district board president who was serving simultaneously on the state school board. And my opinion basically said that this was a conflict of interest. And it was amazing. 2 weeks later, the legislature passed a statute which eliminated the conflict. Basically said it, and the statute basically now permits a member of a local school board to serve on the state school board. That may or may not be maybe that's an example of how effective the legislature can be when it really has an important issue to deal with. But it does raise some concerns about the inequity in the sense that persons who have access to the legislature and to the legislative process are able to exert more influence than those who have less. And I think it would be a sorry state of affairs indeed if one took the position that the only way you can really expect to affect the legislative process is by the professional lobbyist. Obviously, I think there have been some things done to particularly loosen it up. There's always been the opportunity for for constituent communications. The teleconference system, I think, has been an incredible addition to the state process. But again, I guess I'm kind of shooting from the hip on some of my reactions to it. I think the bottom line is task forces make sense in some contexts. The overall problems, the Blue Ribbon Commissions, properly staffed, properly directed, are beneficial, but they're, I don't see a real legislative, particularly in the legislature, a particular orientation towards that approach. Peter?
I think that I want to come back at the same thing from a somewhat different angle, that basically, as George said, there are a number of people who deal with education on a regular basis who have expertise. Of course, each group has its particular prejudices, which sometimes may taint the way in which their expertise is presented, and perhaps not only in our system, the legislature or the State Board of Education and regulatory matters has the responsibility of hopefully culling out the taint from the actual expertise and adopting that which is wisest. I'm not sure that always takes place, but in large regard, the bottom line is that vacuums of power do not stay vacuums very long, and that if somebody doesn't make a decision, somebody else will. I think John Patterson stated very accurately, if you compare the Alaska education statutes with the California education statutes, you're going to, it's a Reader's Digest excerpt of a Book of the Month Club versus War and Peace in the original. They may well have gone too far. I think in many areas we may not have gone far enough. And ultimately, when disputes arise and the types of things that those of us on the panel get involved in, those disputes, if they don't get resolved by the courts. And in my belief, some of those types of disputes, I think the courts are extremely well qualified to deal with, issues such as procedural rights, terminating an employee, perhaps expelling a student, and questions of due process, First Amendment rights, things like that. Those are things which are uniquely within the expertise of courts and people who are trained in that area. But there are a large number of educational policy type decisions that end up getting resolved by the court because nobody else either can or is willing to make a good faith effort at resolving them. And I think in many of those cases that the courts are perhaps the least equipped of all the players to make a decision which takes into consideration all the factors that should be considered in terms of reaching a sound decision. I think one example that comes to my mind, and John and I were both involved in this, would have been the case of the teacher strike that happened here a number of years ago. Ultimately, you could say the case was resolved by the court to the extent that the court enjoined the strike and ordered arbitration, but the problem, what led to the strike and the aftermath of the strike, certainly was not resolved by the court. And furthermore, I think that we would probably, John and I would both agree, and I think at least I'm on record in a brief for the Supreme Court of suggesting that even that which the court did, when it did resolve it in the fashion it did, was perhaps not consistent with the way the statutes are set up, but there was a real situation and the court was there and had to do what it best could do in order to resolve an existing situation. And I suppose my pitch in this regard, without saying which way certain issues should be decided, is that there are a number of issues that have not been addressed that I don't believe the people who are dealing in this area should leave to the lawyers and to the courts to be decided if they can be handled through sound administrative regulations, policy making, and enactment of statutes to fill in some of these voids.
The inconsistency that Peter just mentioned, that this is something that I think I'm sort of obliged to mention here today, is that Judge Carlson actually ordered a sort of a binding arbitration in that case, something that everybody in this room probably knows is not allowed, binding interest arbitration. And just something that probably nobody in this room does know but me and maybe Bankston and Fossey, if either one of them are here, is that recently another Superior Court judge ordered arbitration in another interest case in which we're involved, and we're getting ready to start that arbitration. I think the point of this is that the judges, when they have to scratch their head and figure out how these things have to be solved, resolve to binding interest arbitration. I think that that's the way it has to go. Now, everybody else has lobbied. I can lobby, right? The question here had to do with development of a task force. The comment at the very end of the comment by Mr. Murkowski is that input of the task force should be directed to procedures, how the substantive matter that is developed through the normal input will be carried out. I don't believe that's how it would work, and therein lies my concern about this task force. I believe that if an ex officio, de facto official task force is developed that has some preferential place at the ear of the legislature, that we're going to have a de facto official policy-making body that isn't anticipated by our system. I think that if it's not illegal to do that it's unwise to have such a thing. I can imagine that administrators and school board people, if they predominate in such a task force, would use their opportunity to grind their own axes. And I really don't think that administrators and school board people always have the interest of education and the interest of the children in mind when they make their suggestions. They have a lot of things that they want because it makes it easy for them, because they think they're fantastic anyway, and therefore anything they decide to do is right. Therefore, they should be given all the latitude in the world to do it. I think we need a system with checks and balances, and I think we have a system like that right now. The task force that's been suggested here, I think, will create a weight one way or the other, and from my view, it's the wrong way. Thank you.
I'll come at this from a different angle for a minute. What I'm proposing for school operations and school construction is that you have two different types of approaches. You have a professional, responsible approach when you're dealing with that 45% of the budget deals with education. And then for that other 55%, I hope it's not all pork barrel, but if the pork barrel is going to be there, let it be on that side and not on the education side. I see hope as to what might happen in the future. There is a professional review of our school operations budgets by Associates for Education, Finance, and Planning, Stanford University. It's under a 1981 legislative appropriation. They've just been lined up to do this, I think, a few months ago. And they're going to look at the problems that exist with the school foundation program. There's lots of problems with school foundation programs, lots of odd things. Skagway gets 108% of Juneau Anchorage base. Haines, which is next door, gets 115%. Some very high-cost school districts get up to 145%, which is understandable. But many weird things in that whole program, which have to be ironed out. They have till December 1984 to do it a year from now. To my knowledge, there's no thought of looking at how school construction is being handled in a rapidly growing part of the United States. It's a very important thing because it's a big part of many school districts' budget. It's about a third of our budget, just handling our school debt. About a third of the taxes we raise is just for that one purpose, so it's a serious matter. When the reimbursement for school debt in our district changes from 90% where it is now, it was 80% a couple years ago, but when it changes from 80 to 90% to 50% where it's going to be for a while at least, we sold at least $20 million of bond for which reimbursement is going to be 50%. We're in a new world altogether, a world we've never been in before, and it's going to mean a much heavier load on us locally as far as finances go. I don't agree that all of our state, all of our school district programs are heavily subsidized by state. They always have been in the state and always have been in the territory of Alaska. And yet I think there has been a great deal of school district independence. I don't see that increasing the state's contribution to school construction will eliminate independence of school districts. In California, that argument was made that what an opportunity poor school districts have to improve their educational programs. They can just tax themselves more heavily. And that was connected up with the idea that if it's on you and you don't look to the state for the money, you have much more independence in your decision making. California State Supreme Court called that said fiscal free will is a cruel illusion in the poor districts. It is. And it is in almost every district in this state, all of whom are heavily dependent on the state for school operations and school construction. I hope that one effect of the lawsuit that the Matanuska Susitna Borough has filed is that there will be some sort of court overview of what the legislature does, because I disagree that the legislature has been responsible in handling this sort of thing. I think they've been flippant and irresponsible. Just this past 7 or 8 months, they knew, Governor Sheffield knew, it would take about $94 million to handle school debt reimbursements for the school districts. He put in $49 million in the budget for that purpose, and it's set there, about half proposal to half fund that, half fund what school districts have to come up with to pay for their school bonds. Until fairly late in the session, he came up with another $10 million for $59 million. And it wasn't until after June 15th, after all the school districts in the state had put together their school budgets and their government budgets, set their property tax mill levies, that the legislature finally thought the matter serious enough to address. And they did eventually come up with a full $94 million, not the $49 million that was put in the budget this time last year. Something's wrong with that process. We need certainty, we need professionalism, and we need to politicize it. And we need to have professionals get involved, and that includes the Department of Education. You just can't let these legislators go off and make our little side deals and hope for the best, and that's what's been done to date.
At this time, I'd like to go ahead and open up for questions from the audience to the panelists. The moderator can't be asked any questions. You're welcome to go. I was just joking.
In listening to some terminology, thank you, teacher, for a tune of words, I hear Gary talking about poor school districts. The word poor, a school teacher, a student, is not functioning too well. I'd like to see, when talking about finances, the school district talk in terms of financially strapped, because it may be financially strapped doing an excellent job of teaching junior. So the word bandied about poor, person, the legislator's only half listening. Why give them any money? They're poor district anyhow. Wait till they shake up. So I'd like to see that there, poor in terms of finance, financially strapped, as opposed to poor in the job that they do.
All right.
I think that's a real good point from another standpoint. Poor is the proper choice of words if one looks at the case law. California Supreme Court talks about poor school districts versus wealthy school districts. The one point that none of the court cases talks about is showing that there's any correlation between poor school districts and the quality of education, because as we all know, no one's really been able to nail down what quality is anyway. But it's really interesting, and it's one of the, I'm going to forewarn Gary right now, one of the questions the state is going to be asking is for the Matanuska Susitna Borough to show that the kind of funding it's receiving right now is somehow made it any less able, not in terms of itself, but in comparison to other districts of similar size in this state, to deliver quality education, whether you look at one of 10, 12, 15 different indicia of quality. I think what you'll find, and what several Supreme Courts have found around the country, is that while there is some correlation where you have the drastic differences, you're not going to find, by and large, that kind of disparity. And I think that's the question of poorness and showing a correlation to quality of education is going to be a somewhat difficult direction for the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District to show in particular.
Anybody else? Question here?
No panelists in particular, but be curious what your responses are in terms of legal constraints, consequences of what seems to possibly be a movement in some of the western villages of the state where villages are talking about assuming total autonomy in running their school districts, their schools, completely independent of state or, I wonder, any regulation. I mean, what are the legal perspectives on that kind of a circumstance, and what does that mean for Alaska?
This is my opportunity to become more of one issue panelist. From reading all these things, the Supreme Court cases that Bruce has read too, in every state of the union, education is accorded with special status. Most states not produce to call for a system of public schools, both to all students and so forth, or federal efficient system of public education. And one thing that they don't talk about is two classes of citizens for two classes of opportunities, that kind of thing. Our state comes and to me, that means any system. And that not only includes the individual city and borough school districts, it also includes the REAAs as they exist now and as they might evolve in the future. It will always be one system of state wants to operate on the present constitution. Also, under our constitution, Section 1 provides the equal protection of laws, which means that you don't have special privileges.
That issue or a variant of it came up in a case which has kind of been on ice for the last couple of years, Antioch Village IRA Council versus the state. The issue is quiet largely because the federal government has been cutting off funding for not only the IA schools but also the contract schools. But at that point, a couple of the issues came up, and one of them was whether the village council could compel the state of Alaska to fund, under the foundation program, their IRA school. And we took the position that it couldn't, it was not a public school. To the extent that we have IRA councils who are exercising federal authority to run their schools, a couple of things, some comments about it, if they make that decision, probably free to do so. They will not be funded by the state. I think that's fairly clear. It may also mean, however, that in those same locations, and normally the situation is you have a municipally incorporated community or someone falling within the boundaries of an REAA district. Akiak is a good example of the city council. I know that Jim is well aware, as well as the IRA village council. Wherever a village council decides to run its own school, not only is there a question of no state funding, but it will probably mean that the state will continue to the REAAs probably to have to operate a school there to the extent that there is any citizen in that community who wants to attend a public school. Obviously, there are some limitations under what the so-called five regs, the Mali Hooch regs. No program has to be provided in the five or two students in high school age. Children, as an example, but it will not have any impact in terms of lessening state involvement in the local area. That would be kind of general. Peter may have some comments as well, but he's had to deal with the Mali Hooch early on.
I think I'm generally in agreement with that, but I'm just not familiar with some of the more recent litigation. Sure. Another issue, I assume that the two issues would be one of them, who's going to pay for it, and the other question. Source, to what extent would be the potential private school would be subject to state regulation in terms of certification requirements, graduation requirements, things like that. And my guess, without seeing any particular figure out the answer, because I figured if I figured out the answer, the probably the court would come up with a different answer. So I've encouraged